Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. And we tend to base the show around the ideas of the Enlightenment, things like freedom of expression, free inquiry, scepticism, the scientific method. And we often find ourselves discussing the antithesis of these ideas, such as superstition, religious fundamentalism, totalitarianism, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And our guest today is Philippe Sands, QC. Philippe Sands has been a professor of law at University College London since 2002 and has also taught at Boston College Law School, Cambridge University, and New York University Law School. He is the author of the acclaimed Lawless World, Making and Breaking Global Rules, as well as several other books on international law. He participated in the negotiation of the 1992 Climate Change Convention and the 1998 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. He is a practicing barrister at Matrix Chambers and has been involved in leading cases before English and international courts, including those concerning Senator Augusto Pinochet and the Guantanamo and Belmarsh detainees. Philippe's latest book is Torture Team, Uncovering War Crimes in the Land of the Free. Philippe, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms tonight.
It's terrific to be on your programme.
Let's start. We're going to be talking about torture, deployed it bluntly. But what I'd like to do, first of all, is set the scene by talking about the previous manual that the US Army used, which is something called US Army Field Manual 34-52. This was the sort of touchstone for interrogation techniques for years and years and years up until 2002. So can we start by talking about what that is?
Sure. I mean, it's basically the US Army has a guidebook, the Field Manual, and that sets across the board, the rights and the responsibilities in all policy decisions, so from targeting to the treatment of detainees, including interrogation. And the US Army has long taken the view that in interrogations, the only techniques ultimately that are safe, that are secure, and that produce viable, useful information is a technique known as rapport building, which is basically spending time with the detainee, building trust and confidence, and over time, getting, hopefully, viable, useful information and intelligence. One of the things the Field Manual makes very clear, and in this it applies the rules of the Geneva Conventions, is the use of force is prohibited in all circumstances. Aggression is prohibited in all circumstances. There is to be no physical contact, no abuse, no pressure, no coercion. And that is long established.
So let's talk about when this changed then. The book starts off with there's a printout of the actual memo, which was sent from General Counsel Haines to Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at the time, in August 2002. So what was this?
Well, you need to put the thing in this whole context. Imagine that beyond even the Field Manual, going back to 1863, when President Lincoln issued an edict to the effect that the U.S. Army will not use cruelty in any circumstances, including for reasons of military necessity. Now, of course, that's been the formal rule. We know there have been examples where things have gone wrong, where abuses have happened in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in many other parts of the world. But they were never formally approved. That changed for the first time on the 2nd of December 2002, when Donald Rumsfeld signed a memo authorizing the use of 15 new techniques of interrogation. Some of them seem pretty innocuous, slapping, shouting, yelling. But then as you go up the list, they're divided into three categories. You get to stress positions, nudity, forced grooming, that's the removal of all body hairs, the use of dogs, extremes of temperature, and so on and so forth. And then right up to three categories that were not approved for blanket use but were left available on a case-by-case basis, one of them, of course, being the notorious waterboarding. So the document is a sort of fascinating document, and it's a dastardly document because it's the first time, basically, in 140 years, that the U.S. Army has approved in formal terms the use of cruelty. And the memo's become famous because at the bottom of it, Donald Rumsfeld scrawled in his handwriting, "Why is standing limited to 4 hours? I stand to 8 to 10 hours a day," which some people have taken as a signal to the interrogators that they should go further even than these rules.
So let's talk a little bit about the culture that was surrounding why the decision to change this was made. I mean, why did the people at the top feel that they were in a different situation to what all other people who had been in, you know, war situations in America's past were in?
That's the $64 million question. When this document came out, it came out in the summer of 2004, and it was a sort of a bit of a mistake, I think, to have let it out. But it was part of a narrative that the Bush administration spun, which argued that the abuses at Abu Ghraib had nothing to do with policy. When the administration had wanted to move to what they call enhanced interrogation techniques, they'd done so in response to the request from military people down at Guantanamo. They'd followed the law and they'd exercised due care, due caution, due diligence. And that was the story that they told. And perhaps it was more the barrister in me than the academic. There was something in the way they told that message that sort of got my antennae going and thinking there's something not right about this. So I went around the country over a period of about 2 years, interviewing literally every person who was involved at a senior and junior level in this, and a different story emerged. And what emerged, and this really gets to your question, was that there was enormous pressure from the top, and we're talking about right at the top, Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney, to move to enhanced interrogation techniques, as they call it, torture, as I would call it, in order to get new intelligence to prevent the next attack from happening. In fact, there's a new theory circulating right now, which is that there is some evidence that one of the reasons they moved to these new techniques was that this coincided with the pressing need to find intelligence to justify an attack on Iraq, and that the hope was they would, through the use of these techniques, find intelligence that would draw a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the methods, or not actually, we won't go into the detail of the methods, but there's been a lot of discussion, and you can read discussion on the web about whether or not the definition of torture and whether or not some of these, slapping and nudity techniques would possibly class as torture or not. One of our previous guests on this show, Christopher Hitchens, has very bravely put himself through the through the waterboarding and certainly comes to the conclusion that it is. But I want to look at something more pragmatic than that, which is that, as you mentioned at the top of the show, it's always been the culture in the US military that these techniques just aren't effective anyway.
I mean, it is a remarkable story. What has now emerged, and I've written a little bit about it in the book and others have written more about it, is that what the administration did was reverse engineer techniques that had been used on American detainees in China and in Vietnam and in other parts of the world. They took techniques that were known to be abusive, that were known to be criminal, that were known to be violations of the Geneva Conventions, and then refined them for use on these detainees. And I think they did it without an assessment of how effective they would be. I spent a lot of time talking to interrogators. The vast majority of interrogators that I spoke with in the Department of Defense, in the CIA, said this was a completely useless exercise. These sort of techniques produce information, but they don't produce information that's reliable or that's useful because, essentially, as John McCain put it, there comes a point where you just tell them what you think
they want to know
in order to stop the pain. So there was no proper assessment. It was a sort of knee-jerk response without taking into account years and years of practice. And, of course, it's now all come to an end because, as it turns out, well, there's a bit of a debate about it in the US, it didn't produce much by the way of meaningful information.
But I suppose also it's now coming out that, and it's been coming out for a while, that a lot of the guys they were picking up, they were just picking people up at pretty much at random or sort of in wholesale anyway, weren't they?
I spent hours and hours interviewing the head of interrogations at Guantanamo in the first year, that famous first year, 2002, a guy called Mike Dunleavy, a judge, who's a part-time reserve officer, intelligence officer. And he described to me how he got down to Guantanamo in February 2002, and within a couple of months, he realized that the screening processes in Afghanistan had been completely useless and presented him with hundreds of non-entities, individuals who had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism, absolutely nothing to do with al-Qaeda, and some nothing to do even with the Taliban. They'd been shipped over there, and he wanted to get rid of them because they were making his job, as he described to me, more difficult. And so he went up to the Pentagon, and he claims he spoke with the number three in the Pentagon, Doug Feith, and said, get rid of these people. They're just getting in the way of proper intelligence and proper interrogations of people who are serious people that we ought to be looking at. And the word came back, no, we want to keep them all. But I think they knew very early on that in the hundreds and hundreds of people, most of them were completely irrelevant. But they needed to save face, and they needed to keep them there. And some of them are still there.
There was just going back to what we were talking about a minute ago about, you know, what was the sort of culture like of you know, why did these guys think they were sort of facing some sort of new type of, you know, combatants and an unprecedented type of war or whatever. There's a fantastic quote in the book from Mike Dunleavy that you've just mentioned, when you talk to him about, and we'll talk perhaps more specifically about detainee number 63, which is the person you talk about most in the book. But he says this quote about, you know, why we should be interrogating this particular person. This guy might have the key to the survival of the US, which is, I can't even begin to get my head around what he means by that.
You know, the thing that was most surreal about it was that he genuinely believed it. So I'm sitting with him and talking, and he describes himself to me as the point at the tip of the sphere that is protecting the United States. And I've got no doubt that he'd got himself sort of, you know, into the sort of frenzied belief that actually detainee 063, who was alleged to be the 20th hijacker by the name of Mohammed Al-Qahtani, who was tortured over a 54-day period in application of these Rumsfeld-approved techniques, I think Dunleavy genuinely believed that he had access to information that would, you know, be gotten out of his head, as Rumsfeld put it. Now, what experienced interrogators told me was that interrogating a man like Al-Qahtani, detainee 063, a year after he's been detained is a totally useless exercise by reference to aggressive techniques of interrogation. And interrogator after interrogator would explain to me that the only moment when aggression, enhanced techniques, cruelty, call it what you will, works is at the moment of capture. And I was told time and time again that in the 4 to 6 hour period after someone is caught on the battlefield, basically, if you want to find out what's going on, all you need to do is put them in a helicopter, take the helicopter 20 feet off the ground, blindfold them, open the door and threaten to push them out, and they will speak. Now, every interrogator said to me, we didn't use those techniques, and we are not saying they should be used. But they said that's the point and the only point at which this stuff might work. When you've had someone in detention for a year, and they have had a chance to recenter themselves, get themselves sorted out, build up their sense of self, aggression is a hopeless technique, and that is, you know, established across the world.
Let's talk about the sort of trajectory of the book then. You basically set out to interview a number of the, you know, the major players in this, starting from, you know, the people right at the bottom, presumably, and sort of working your way up eventually to the people that are now labelled the Bush Six, which are the, you know, the sort of the senior lawyers. And but let's talk about the, you know, the process of interviewing. How did you set out upon that?
Well, I didn't know any of these people. I mean, most of them were invisible. They were not big names. One or two did have reasonably big names. But I knew I needed to find one person to open the door to a conversation on the record. Once I had got one person, I knew I'd be able to go to the next person. And the next person I'd be able to say, well, your colleague X said Y and Z, and what's your views on that? And the trick was to get the first person to speak. And the first person who really did speak very openly was Diane Beaver. She was a lawyer down at Guantanamo. She was basically the lawyer to Mike Dunleavy. And she was wheeled out to give, you know, early approval to these new techniques of interrogation. She was an invisible person. I mean, her name appeared on the memo. But if you Google searched her 4 years ago when I started, she was nothing but her legal advice. So I had to track her down. She was still in the military. And through a friend of mine who worked at the State Department, who had worked with her on a small project several years ago, I was introduced. And it took several telephone conversations and several sort of pre-meetings to build up confidence. And eventually, we sat on several occasions and talked and talked and talked. And of course, once I'd got from her information that had never come into the public domain, for example, you know, an executive jet flying down from Washington, turning up at Guantanamo with the lawyer to the president, with the lawyer to the vice president, with the lawyer to Mr. Rumsfeld, coming to Guantanamo to talk about detainee 063 and basically put the pressure on her and Dunleavy to do the right thing and duff him up a bit, I could go to the next person up the chain of command. And I got literally right to the very top. I mean, I spent time with Rumsfeld's lawyer. I had two lengthy meetings with him in the Pentagon. They were off-the-record meetings, and I've respected that fact. But I got enough out of him that enabled me to confirm the main conclusions of my book. And so it was a process It was very time-consuming. It took 2 years. I'd periodically be in the States doing a piece of work, giving a lecture or doing a case or an arbitration, and I'd be introduced to someone. And it took a long time, but I pieced together, you know, the various parts of a complex puzzle and eventually wrote the book. And, of course, what's been shown is that the narrative that I came up with, which is that it came from the top, it was imposed, it was based on legal advice that had come from the Department of Justice, some of the memos of which have now just been released by President Obama, very connected to my story, was accurate. And the Senate Armed Services Committee has pretty much signed off on the entire story that I've told.
Well, then there's no need for us to go over. We won't spoil the end of the book for listeners, but we'll move on to Obama then. So when you listen to Little Atoms, I'm talking to Philip Sands QC, and we're talking about his book, Torture Team, Uncovering War Crimes in the Land of the Free. So as you've just mentioned, Philip, in the last few weeks, President Obama has been quite outspoken on what he thinks about these methods and about whether or not America should use torture. So let's talk about what happened, basically what he said.
Well, he, since he's come into office, has transformed the picture. He has long been opposed to all these techniques of interrogation. Within 2 days of coming to office, he had announced the closure of Guantanamo and, more significantly, the end of all these techniques of interrogation and the reinstatement of the international conventions that people like me have been sort of batting on about for the last 4 or 5 years. So Geneva is back, the Torture Convention is back and right up there. But interestingly, in his executive order, which is called Ensuring Lawful Interrogations, he fingers the lawyers. And there's a wonderful passage in that first executive order in which President Obama directs any interrogator acting on behalf of the United States to take no account whatsoever of any Department of Justice legal opinion written between September 11th, 2001 and January the 20th, 2009. And that, I think, says it all. It's Obama recognizing that the source of everything that went wrong was a small group of ideological lawyers who were basically handpicked by the administration to sign on the dotted line. And that's why there's now this focus on these lawyers. President Obama himself has recognized they have a degree of responsibility.
And this follows in that he said that there will be no prosecution of the actual the CIA agents who have actually been doing the interrogation. But he hasn't, interestingly, said there will be no prosecution.
Well, he's a seriously impressive guy. I mean, he released the legal memos, the torture memos that have come to be a new raft of them that I thought I'd been hardened to some of this stuff. But you read these documents, they really are extraordinary. And simultaneous with the release of those documents, he puts out a statement in which he says, look, any interrogator of the CIA who relied in good faith on these techniques will not, in our view, be the target of prosecutions. So I read that really carefully, and I thought, that's interesting. It's interesting because basically I think it's right in the sense that those are not the people who should be hung out to dry. But what he's not saying in that statement is that there should be no criminal investigations. And indeed, after he wrote his statement a couple of weeks ago, I did an op-ed in The Guardian, and I said exactly that. Let's take a bit of time over this, because he's been a man who chooses his words very carefully. The day after that, on a Sunday, Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, is asked about exactly this issue. And Rahm Emanuel says, no, President Obama did limit it, but in fact he goes further and says no prosecutions, period. But that wasn't actually what he said. And then the day after that, Rahm Emanuel is contradicted, overturned by Obama, who is asked, what about the framers of the legal decisions, which is shorthand for the lawyers, or longhand for the lawyers. And he says, as regards the framers of the legal decisions, that is another matter completely. That's for the Attorney General, and I'm not going to prejudge that issue. And there's some sense now in the last couple of days coming out of Washington that the Attorney General may actually surprise us and announce some sort of internal investigation about the lawyers.
Also, in the past couple of weeks, Dick Cheney has been appearing on TV and basically saying that he is aware of documents that would show that, you know, good information was gotten out of people by using by the use of this technique. So I mean, this stuff is not there, is it? It's not going to come to light, is it?
Well, that may be the case. I haven't seen that material. I've spoken to interrogators, and they've given me their views that contradict that. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, the documents that Dick Cheney has read, this is a man who on the 27th of August 2002 told a group of U.S. veterans that he had seen the intelligence, which demonstrated conclusively that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So I suspect that Dick Cheney and I will read the same documents and interpret them in very, very different ways. The bottom line of it is, though, he's right. Let's get that stuff out and let's see what it says. But let's also put out the interrogation logs. Let's put out the photographs. Let's put out the videos and the audios of the interrogations. And let's put out the analyses of what the consequences of the move to abuse has been for American reputation and authority around the world. And then let's have a full and informed debate. And I have no doubt whatsoever, if all of that stuff were to come out, the chips would fall in such a way in which overwhelmingly people would conclude this stuff is, not only does it not work, but it's dangerous, it undermines us, it makes us less safe and less secure. That was the British experience in Northern Ireland, and I've got no doubt the experience here will be the same.
You, in this open letter that you wrote to Cheney in The Guardian, you talk of some of the examples. You just mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you've recently seen some of this new stuff that's come to light, and you've been shocked yourself, even though you've been working on this for years. Let's just talk about one particular example that you give here, which is of the as you said, the notorious waterboarding idea, which is, I mean, it says that Congressman Trent Franks reported that waterboarding was used on only three men and that in each case it lasted no more than 1 minute. OK, so if you know, fill us in with what has subsequently come to light.
Well, that came out. It was pretty, with hindsight, it was pretty entertaining. I testified on three occasions. I never testified before the US Congress, so I'm invited to come over and testify about my book. And I appear for the first time, and the ranking Republican, that's to say the most senior Republican, is this guy called Congressman Trent Franks. And he makes an introductory statement. He says, well, I don't know what all the wittering honor is about. You know, I've been told by the director of the CIA that three men were waterboarded for no more than a total of 1 minute each, i.e. grand total of 3 minutes. So, frankly, I just don't know what all this fuss is about. And he, you know, used it to sort of swat away this irritating Brit who'd flown over from London to appear before him. What's all the fuss about? Well, what has now turned out, actually in an accidental way, is that one of the memos released 2 weeks ago was not properly redacted. And one of them got into the public domain that had one of the footnotes not properly blacked out. So some smart bod in California, I think it was, managed to sort of unscramble the text and see that what the footnote said was that two of these characters had been waterboarded a total of 266 times, which is just...
not so easy to swat away.
It's just breathtaking. I mean, you've got to ask yourself the question, when you've done it 10 times...
Or, and they've not broken.
And yeah. The person has... what are you going to get out when you've got to waterboarding effort number 149? And in the end, this guy who was waterboarded 183 times, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this is, of course, is the character who has owned up to everything under sun, including the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So you really just need to have a sort of reality check about what is going on here. I mean, it is bonkers sort of stuff that Dick Cheney and others are going on about. Once you've had to go through that process, surely you ask yourself the question, what is the utility of this process?
We're quickly running out of time, but you mentioned that you're quite hopeful that there will probably be an inquiry. What do you think are the chances of there actually being a criminal investigation?
Well, there is a criminal investigation now. Just big news this week, of course, not in Washington and not in the US, but in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Garzón, he of Pinochet fame, has announced a very far-reaching inquiry, which is going to go, I think, very far and ensnare not only the Bush six, not only the lawyers, but I think it's going to go higher up. I think the consequence of that is it's going to ratchet up the pressure for the US to get its own house in order. And I think it's right that the US should sort this out. And I think inevitably there's going to be some form of inquiry or investigation in the US. Whether it's criminal or non-criminal is a complex issue. Once you have a criminal investigation, people start clamming up. And people who clam up means that the information doesn't get into the public domain. So there's a tension between criminal inquiry and the sort of truth and reconciliation process. And the jury's still out, I think, as to what is the better way to go and what way Obama will go.
Philippe, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Very much, and carry on the terrific work.